Chapter 55. I don't think they spoke together again. The boat entered a narrow by channel, where it was pushed by the oar blades set in two crumbling banks, and there was a gloom, as if enormous black wings had been outspread above the mist, that filled its depth to the summits of the trees. The branches overhead showered big drops through the gloomy fog. At a mutter from Cornelius, Brown ordered his men to load. I'll give you a chance to get even with them before we're done, you dismal cripples, you, he said to his gang. Mind you don't throw it away, you hounds. Low growls answered that speech. Cornelius showed much fussy concern for the safety of his canoe. Meantime, Tam Item had reached the end of his journey. The fog had delayed him a little, but he had paddled steadily, keeping in touch with the south bank. By and by daylight came like a glow in a ground glass globe. The shores made on each side of the river a dark smudge, in which one could detect hints of columnar forms and shadows of twisted branches high up. The mist was still thick on the water, but a good watch was being kept, for as Iamitum approached the camp the figures of two men emerged out of the white vapor, and voices spoke to him boisterously. He answered, and presently a canoe lay alongside, and he exchanged news with the paddlers. All was well. The trouble was over. Then the men in the canoe let go their grip on the side of his dugout, and incontinently fell out of sight. He pursued his way till he heard voices coming to him quietly over the water, and saw, under the now lifting, swirling mist, the glow of many little fires burning on a sandy stretch, backed by lofty thin timber and bushes. There again a lookout was kept, for he was challenged. He shouted his name as the two last sweeps of his paddle ran his canoe upon the strand. It was a big camp. Men crouched in many little knots under a subdued murmur of early morning talk. Many thin threads of smoke curled slowly on the white mist. Little shelters, elevated above the ground, had been built for the chiefs. Muskets were stacked in small pyramids, and long spears were stuck singly into the sand near the fires. Tam Item, assuming an air of importance, demanded to be led to Dane Wars. He found the friend of his white lord lying on a raised couch made of bamboo, and sheltered by a sort of shed of sticks covered with mats. Dane Warris was awake, and a bright fire was burning before his sleeping place, which resembled a rude shrine. The only son of Nakota Dorman answered his greeting kindly. Tam Item began by handing him the ring which vouched for the truth of the messenger's words. Dane Warris, reclining on his elbow, bade him speak and tell all the news. Beginning with the consecrated formula, the news is good, Tam Item delivered Jim's own words. The white men, deputing with the consent of all the chiefs, were to be allowed to pass down the river. In answer to a question or two, Tam Item then reported the proceedings of the last council. Dane Warris listened attentively to the end, toying with the ring which ultimately he slipped on the forefinger of his right hand. After hearing all he had to say, he dismissed Tam Item to have food and rest. Orders for the return in the afternoon were given immediately. Afterwards, Dane Warris lay down again, open-eyed, while his personal attendants were preparing his food at the fire, by which Tam Item also sat talking to the men who lounged up to hear the latest intelligence from the town. The sun was eating up the mist. A good watch was kept upon the reach of the main stream, where the boat of the whites was expected to appear every moment. It was then that Brown took his revenge upon the world which, after 20 years of contemptuous and reckless bullying, refused him the tribute of a common robber's success. It was an act of cold-blooded ferocity, and it consoled him on his deathbed like a memory of an indomitable defiance. Stealthily he landed his men on the other side of the island opposite to the Bugis camp, and led them across. After a short, but quite silent scuffle, Cornelius, who had tried to slink away at the moment of landing, resigned himself to show the way, where the undergrowth was most sparse. Brown held both his skinny hands together behind his back in the grip of one vast fist, and now and then impelled him forward with a fierce push. Cornelius remained as mute as a fish, abject but faithful to his purpose, whose accomplishment loomed before him dimly. At the edge of the patch of forest, Brown's men spread themselves out in cover and waited. The camp was plain from end to end before their eyes, and no one looked their way. Nobody even dreamed that the white men could have any knowledge of the narrow channel at the back of the island. When he judged the moment come, Brown yelled, "Let them have it," and 14 shots rang out like one. Tam Item told me the surprise was so great that, except for those who fell dead or wounded, not a soul of them moved for quite an appreciable time after the first discharge. Then a man screamed, and after that scream a great yell of amazement and fear went up from all the throats. A blind panic drove these men in a surging, swaying mob to and fro along the shore like a herd of cattle afraid of the water. Some few jumped into the river then, but most of them did so only after the last discharge. 3 times Brown's men fired into the ruck. Brown, the only one in view, cursing and yelling, "Aim low, aim low." Tam Item says that, as for him, he understood at the first volley what had happened. Though untouched, he fell down and lay as if dead, but with his eyes open. At the sound of the first shot, Stain Warris, reclining on the couch, jumped up and ran out upon the open shore, just in time to receive a bullet in his forehead at the second discharge. Tam Item saw him fling his arms wide open before he fell. Then, he says, a great fear came upon him not before. The white men retired as they had come unseen. Thus Brown balanced his account with the evil fortune. Notice that even in this awful outbreak there is a superiority, as of a man who carries right the abstract thing within the envelope of his common desires. It was not a vulgar and treacherous massacre. It was a lesson, a retribution, a demonstration of some obscure and awful attribute of our nature which, I am afraid, is not so very far under the surface as we like to think. Afterwards the whites depart unseen by Tam Item, and seem to vanish from before men's eyes altogether, and the schooner too, vanishes after the manner of stolen goods. But a story is told of a white longboat picked up a month later in the Indian Ocean by a cargo steamer. 2 parched, yellow, glassy-eyed, whispering skeletons in her recognized the authority of a third, who declared that his name was Brown. His schooner, he reported, bound south with a cargo of Java sugar, had sprung a bad leak, and sank under his feet. He and his companions were the survivors of a crew of 6. The 2 died on board the steamer which rescued them. Brown lived to be seen by me, and I can testify that he had played his part to the last. It seems, however, that in going away they had neglected to cast off Cornelius's canoe. Cornelius himself Brown had let go at the beginning of the shooting, with a kick for a parting benediction. Tam Item, after arising from amongst the dead, saw the Nazarene running up and down the shore amongst the corpses and the expiring fires. He uttered little cries. Suddenly he rushed to the water, and made frantic efforts to get one of the Bugis boats into the water. Afterwards, till he had seen me, related Tam Item, he stood looking at the heavy canoe and scratching his head. W. What became of him? I asked. Tam Item, staring hard at me, made an expressive gesture with his right arm. T. Twice I struck, Tuan, he said. When he beheld me approaching, he cast himself violently on the ground and made a great outcry, kicking. He screeched like a frightened hen till he felt the point. Then he was still, and lay staring at me, while his life went out of his eyes. This done, Tam Item did not tarry. He understood the importance of being the first with the awful news at the fort. There were, of course, many survivors of Dane Warris's party, but in the extremity of panic some had swum across the river, others had bolted into the bush. The fact is that they did not know really who struck that blow, whether more white robbers were not coming, whether they had not already got hold of the whole land. They imagined themselves to be the victims of a vast treachery, and utterly doomed to destruction. It is said that some small parties did not come until 3 days afterwards. However, a few tried to make their way back to Patchison at once, and one of the canoes that were patrolling the river that morning was in sight of the camp at the very moment of the attack. It is true that at first the men in her leaped overboard and swam to the opposite bank, but afterwards they returned to their boat and started fearfully upstream. Of these tam item at an hour's advance. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.